This podcast is brought to you by the Specialty Produce Network.
They say that spooning leads to forking, and they may be right. But Michael Gardner and Shane Fisher have a different take on the fine art of spooning and bring it to you weekly by delving into the corners, bright and dark, of today's food scene, from the business of food to the back of the house and what ends up on the plate.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 20 of The Art of Spooning. I'm Shane Fisher and my partner over here, Michael Gardner. This is part one of 7 days in the Valle de Guadalupe, and we're going to do all 7 days in a couple of half-hour segments.
We are. And welcome to those of you in Facebook Live land. As usual, we're going to be recording two approximately half-hour podcasts today. We'll take a break between the two of them ourselves, but the feed will continue, and it's going to be fun.
I think so. Let's start off with our first guest, W. Scott Koenig. So do we call you W or Scott?
You can call me Scott.
All right. We'll go Scott. If you paid any attention for you guys out there in Facebook Live land to what's happening on the food scene and the wine scene south of our border, you may or may not have heard of Scott. If you have heard of him, I'm sorry. But Scott runs the A Gringo in Mexico blog, found at agringoinmexico.com. Subject matter expert for Foodie Hub, which has recently gone through a name and branding change.
They are a little bit. It's now extremefoodies.tv.
Does that mean
that's with an X, not an EX?
Does that mean that you like eat food while you're ziplining?
Yeah, exactly. The X food games, as it were. It's a little messy,
X Hunger Games.
It's fun. Yeah.
You still writing for San Diego Red?
I do a little bit of writing for San Diego Red. I've been writing also for Discover Baja Travel Club. They've been in business for, 30 years. They provide Mexican auto insurance. That's also a sponsor, so yes, that is a plug. That's been fun, too. I've been writing about food down in Baja for their blog. So
cool.
And just like the rest of us really serious food people that do this for a living, you have a day job that kind of supports your family, right?
I am a creative director and a graphic designer by day for over 30 years, and the gringo thing is really what you'd call my passe tiempo, or my hobby, my pastime.
Gotcha. We might want to mention. Oh, go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, isn't gringo semi curse word?
It depends. You know, a lot of people, including Drew,
I prefer don't necessarily
right. Don't necessarily like the word gringo. But when I did it, it was really, I wanted to designate that I'm an outsider. I barely speak the language. I do a little bit, very, very poorly. And I'm down here reporting on something that I'm not necessarily a part of, or at least when I started writing about it, I wasn't. So I didn't want to be so, presumptuous that, you know, hey, I'm the Mexican insider. I'm a guy on the outside just like you, going to Mexico, eating great food, getting involved in great cultural events, and really enjoying the country. And you too. You know, gringos and gringa can do this yourself. Because my original intent was to have more of a Southern California U.S. audience. What's happened since is actually a lot of people down in Baja and a lot of the Mexican people now read my blog as well.
Well, so. And let's face it, El Chino in Mexico was already taken. So we should mention one minor detail. Scott's also the author of the book sitting here right in front of me, 7 Days in the Valle.
Yes.
And that just dropped recently.
It just dropped in March. It's available via paperback and also ebook. The paperback, you can go to my website. There's a big ad in the front page, A Gringo in Mexico. Click through. You can buy it through Amazon, online, Barnes & Noble, or directly from my website, and I'll actually sign the copy and ship it to you directly.
Or if you get down here to Specialty Produce really quickly, you can steal Sheen's copy right there.
Good luck.
Well, our second guest, our second to none, is Drew Deckman. Drew's the chef owner of Deckman's in El Morgor in Valle Guadalupe, named both for our guest Drew Deckman and for the place that it's located, Morgor Baden Winery.
Buenos dias.
Buenos dias. ¿Cómo estás?
Excelentísimo.
If you know one thing about Drew, it's probably that he is the proud earner of a Michelin star at restaurant Vitus in Reinsdorf, Germany. My German's a little bit rusty.
Yes, it's mine.
It's not the only honor that he's won. He was rising star chef in Berlin in 2003 and was host chef at the James Beard Foundation's Baja Meets New York City in 2014.
That's it. Yeah, that was a great event.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What was it like cooking there?
Well, you know, it's sort of you walk in and there's all these – this aura. You know, it's a house. So the kitchen's
the James Beard house.
The James Beard house. The kitchen's really small.
Yeah.
And it was an adventure. I ended up being in New York City 18 days and cooked in 10 different venues. And it was crazy. But and the finale was the Beard house dinner. And we brought wines from the valley, and we had mezcal from Oaxaca, and actually brought in seafoods, and things had all kinds of different, you know, between.
So it wasn't exactly 0 kilometer there.
It was not 0 kilometer. Well, we made a lot of people at the border happy with their little propinas.
Yeah, I would bet you did. for those of you who don't know, I mean, many people look at the name James Beard, and what they think is the James Beard Awards or the house. James Beard was actually a real human being. And it's fair to say, I think, that none of us would be sitting here doing this show right now if it had not been for James Beard. He was a very well-known food writer for the New York Times. He was, in some ways, one of the first celebrity food writers. He established the New York Times as kind of the food news of record at a time that there was no food news of record.
Right, correct.
The house in question was actually his house in New York City.
Right.
So when you go and you attend a dinner or cook at a dinner at the Beard House, you're actually very, very, very truly going back in time and paying honor to the reason that we're all able to do this.
And it was, for me, the most interesting thing. I thought it was a big deal, but they do like 300 of these a year. So
it still is a big deal.
It is, but at the end of the night, you know, we're starting to sort of enjoy the evening. We're done working. And they basically come in and they just sort of they kind of shove you out onto the street. Because I got to get ready for the next day.
Right.
So there's another guy coming in tomorrow for his 15 minutes.
So no time for warm fuzzies you're saying.
No, it was like, get your stuff together. We got to get ready for the next guy coming in tomorrow.
Thanks for coming. What was your name again? Yeah,
right. but that's the thing. It's not what was your name again, because the simple reality is that as many people do it, nobody does it who isn't somebody who hasn't accomplished something in the food world. Who isn't worthy? I mean, there's the rides on Disneyland. You must be this high to get on this ride.
Sure.
Well, you know, same thing with the James Beard House. And you know, I mean, there are a lot of chefs in this country who are happy to be line cooks at a James Beard House dinner.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, it really is something special.
It was an amazing experience for sure.
But you know,
who are you cooking for? At one of those dinners.
Anybody who buys a ticket. So there's in the foundation, they have members who receive the invitations to the dinner. They pay for it. The chefs are responsible for paying for all their own ingredients. There is some sponsorship through the foundation, but you're also responsible for acquiring all your own beverages.
Wow.
So it's not, you know, they don't, there's no housing, and there's no transportation. It's, if you want to do this, Come show us that you're dedicated in doing it. And a lot of chefs, when they get asked to do it, they have like fundraisers or crowdfunding kind of things to raise the money to be able to have that experience.
Yeah. Now, staff, are they providing you some line cooks or whatever? You bring in some of your own staff?
They have dishwashers, and that's it.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. You got to bring your own staff.
You bring your whole kitchen, basically.
Everybody, yeah.
Wow.
And they've got equipment, and it's the top-of-the-line stuff and all that, but No, you're the team and the goods. You're bringing it all you.
For a lot of chefs, the team is not just the current team, because actually the current team is back home putting food out in the home based restaurant. It almost ends up being a who's who of anyone who came out of that kitchen. So you know the top sous who went and opened his own spot and is quite a name in their own right. I mean they're sometimes all star staff. Back there,
we
in the
had
kitchen.
Fun. It was all a bunch of good friends.
Who'd you have?
I don't remember any of their names.
Well, you didn't have time. They were kicking you out the door. Right. You finished washing dishes, man. Hey, let's bring this back to the volume.
Yep.
Scott, let's talk about a little bit. How did you become – well, how did you choose Mexico? Why the blog? How did it get started?
Well, you know, the blog I call my midlife crisis. It's not a red convertible that I'm driving around in and picking up young women.
You've spent way more money on this than a convertible, I'm sure.
At this point, who knows? I've always enjoyed going to Mexico. We started going down to Baja when I first moved to San Diego back in the mid-90s. And back then, we kind of did the gringo trail. We went to Tijuana, hung out in Revue, did the two-for-one tacos and the free margaritas. And then we got a little further afield as time
free,
went on. And
free margaritas? Where do you?
Two for one. You buy you one, got, you get one.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, send me that address.
Senior Frogs. It's Senior Frogs, isn't it?
Back in the 90s, before 9/11, Revue was bumping. I mean, it was still kind of a hot place to go. You had a lot of people from the U.S. That were down there partying. I mean, my wife went there when she was a teenager, without even needing a fake ID to party at the clubs and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
So it was really a different scene then. Now it's more geared toward the people that live there. It's calmed down quite a bit. You don't have the guys with the whistles so much and the come-ons.
They're
to come
still
get
there.
You.
They're still there.
But to a much lesser extent,
yeah.
I think.
I had the opportunity to be there early in the morning because I was cooking at a restaurant there. And it was very different than I remembered early in the morning from back in the day.
Well, it depends on if you're arriving.
Exactly. Back way back then, I was leaving at that time. And now
you're
I was
getting
there.
Yourself up off the sidewalk and going, what the hell happened? Right. On your way. So we started going a little further afield then as we got more adventurous. And we'd go down to La Fonda and have the lobster, of course, and the Sunday brunch. And it really wasn't until 2012 that I visited the Valle for the first time. It was my wife and I's anniversary. I forget which one. And we went on a hotel tour from Las Rocas Hotel. And I actually met a gentleman who the tour guide, who I'm still very good friends with, and he helps us out with tours that we do now, Fernando Cuevas from Tours in Baja. Hey, Fernando, if you're watching. And we went down there, and it was just this, it was like a dream, where suddenly this big open valle opens up. There's grapevines everywhere. It's got that mellowness of Mexico. You can go eat and have a 3-4 hour dinner, very relaxing. We went on that tour up to El Cheto, which, by the way, a lot of people knock Cheto, but there's a lot of history there, and they've also got a lot of good wine. But we went to Cheto.
Not always the wine that you see in the shops, not the ones that are mass marketed, but some of their higher level wines are really terrific.
I had a 2006 Nebbiolo at an event a few months ago, and Marco Amador, who's the sommelier there, had it with him, and it was one of the best reds I've had of any type ever. And I said, "How do I get this?" And he goes, "Well, you got to know somebody." But they do have a premium.
Aren't you somebody?
Yeah, he is. Yeah, exactly. Well, hey, man, come on. He keeps those in the back of his trunk, I imagine. So we went up to the bullring on the back of the property there at El Cheto, and it just gives you this expansive view of the entire valle. And my wife and I were smitten from that point on.
And so you decided to write about it.
Yeah. Well, it started out the blog really as trip reports, because we would go. We had been to Oaxaca. We'd been to Michoacán for Dia de los Muertos. We'd been to the Yucatan. We'd kind of been all over Mexico. And since the early 2000s, I've been in the habit of keeping a travel journal when I go anywhere that's halfway interesting. And so somehow that travel journal became a blog, which was simply kind of reporting on our trips. And then from there, I started working actually for Baja.
That's the origin of blogs, is that they were basically journals,
journals on the internet. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Drew, there's a quote in your book from Drew about the Valle. I'm not really a New Age sort of person, but when I came to the Valle de Guadalupe for the first time, I felt like I'd been here before. It made my soul feel calm. What the hell does that mean?
That pretty much sums it up.
What does it mean?
That's it. Can I go now? No, honestly, my very, very first trip to the Valle, I had no idea what to expect. I had never been there before. I was working in Los Cabos and was invited on sort of a fam trip of other people who were buying wine and whatever. And it was actually a sponsored thing that Montchenique had had paid for when they had first opened their new barrel cave.
Right.
So this is 10 years ago, maybe.
Yeah.
And you know, okay, we flew into Tijuana. It's first time in Tijuana. It's kind of like, you know, and then you get in this bus and you're driving and all of a sudden you come up. I didn't know what to expect. And you come over the hill and then you see the vineyards just kind of spread out in front of you. And it was just like, whoa, this is a place where I think I want to be. And it took me, you know, 3 or 4 years after that before I was actually, you know, I just sort of increased my time there and had some more opportunities, did some guest chef stuff, and then did some consulting with Uva Costa, which was a lot of fun. It's not necessarily a place where you can just walk in and go say, hey, I'm here, and especially not then. Now it's sort of like anybody who's got $10 in their pocket, they buy two chairs and a table and they call it a restaurant. But
And people show up.
They fill both chairs. They say they have a full restaurant.
Tell us how you really feel.
Yeah, right, exactly. No, it's we can get into that a little later with the vertical exponential growth that's happening. But, I liked it enough that I wanted to make it the place where I live.
Yeah, you said in an interview way back when, you probably don't remember, but that as you were transitioning, I don't even know when you started considering transitioning, but you said, you know, the more time you spent in the Valle, the more frustrated you got in Cabo.
And that's absolutely the truth because Guadalupe Valley, Ensenada, Northern Baja – is a place that really is a mecca for everything that makes my life as a chef work. Ingredients, beverage production, great seafoods, climate, and in a sort of an aquarium in the sense that once you get there, unless you like to ride your road bike, there's not a whole lot to do. You know, it's not like we have warm water and you're going to go jump in, you know, you go to Cabo, you go for a bunch of different things. You go for golf, you go for the party, you go for the beach, you go for...
Kind of like San Diego.
But, with
more avocados.
Or you go sport fishing. And then the eating is sort of a necessary evil that happens when you're there. And so it's a really transient marketplace is what I experienced when I was there. Nobody really cared where the food was from. Mm-hmm. Nobody really was – because they're here 3 or 4 days and, they have no context into, hey, this farm's over here. Don't you care? No, I really don't. Do I get
– Where's the margaritas?
Right, exactly. Right. So
the two-for-one margaritas.
Spent in the Valley, the more time I was active in the winemaking process, the more time the more I got to know ranchers and producers and farmers and fishermen – the closer I felt to what I was doing. And so every time I went back, it was just like, I missed that. I wanted more of it. And that was, in the end, it was Uva Costa who said, because in my restaurant in Cabo, I was the first restaurant to go 100% Mexican wines. And when we did, everybody said, don't do that. Nobody's going to want it. And, you know, Mexican wines don't work. I said, well, they do work if you don't put Chileans that cost half the price next to them on the same the same menu. So we did 135 labels and gangbusters. It was great. And eventually Uva Costa said to me, said, Drew, we appreciate what you're doing for the Valley, but if you really want to do something for the Valley, you should be here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that was the end. That was sort of like, okay, pack it up.
So you both basically just said the same thing, been all over Mexico, been in, you know, doing whatever, but it was the Valley.
Mm-hmm.
That really kind of made things coalesce for you in terms of why you wanted to be there and
what your vision was totally. Moving forward. Is yeah, that for fair
me,
to that, say?
Yeah, for me, that's definitely the case.
Yeah, the Valle is one of my easily one of my top three favorite places in all of Mexico, no doubt. And Drew's spot is exemplary of the Valle too.
Oh, yes.
I mean, you know, you go there; it's all wood cooking. So he's got this huge handmade hearth in the middle of the operation there. That's, you know, they're plating, they're cooking. Every time I go there, I think Drew's got a new Santa Maria grill that's been installed. So, I mean, it's just this smoking
well,
amazing
for people
food.
Who don't know, one of the really important things to understand about Drew's restaurant and Drew's cooking is there's no electricity. There's no gas that's fueling.
There's no gas. We do have electricity.
There's no, but the ovens aren't fueled by electricity.
No, it's all, everything's wood fired.
Everything is wood fired. And by the way, where does the wood come from?
Comes from the ranch, for the most part, and if not, from Ojos Negros.
Yeah, so it's, you know, everything is done on fire. That doesn't mean everything's grilled.
No, our kitchen's wood fired.
Yeah. And, you know, there are advantages that come to that from a flavor perspective, but it's, you know, for a Michelin-starred chef, it's got to be challenging not to have the kind of control of a dial.
Well, it's you know, standing in the same square for 6 years and kind of understanding a little bit about what's going on, but every day it's different because your ambient temperature affects it, wind direction and wing strength affects it. The firewood is not always exactly the same. So sometimes it's drier, sometimes it's wetter. So there's just a million variables.
When you break it down to its most elemental phase, isn't a chef a man
controlling
knife,
fire
and fire?
Yeah, absolutely. Sure.
Pretty much.
Yeah, a little bit of salt.
So that's pretty. Yeah. God. Don't get me started on salt, man. But
oh, God.
Thank
please.
God you use it is all I'm going to say.
Yeah. And Drew, you use San Felipe a sea salt almost exclusively,
it's the
don't
only
you?
Salt we use, yeah.
Which is fantastic from San Felipe from a gentleman named Francisco Sosa there. There's another plug. It's my favorite salt as well. He's got a lot of different types of salts. I like the garlic.
Yeah, we don't use any of the flavored salts, but he produces a couple of different quality levels for us. All of it or most of it's hand harvested, some from outside of where his actually salt mine is.
Mm-hmm.
They sort of rake harvest some salt that looks like Maldon when it comes in.
Is that flaky?
It's
flat
square,
and flaky?
Yeah, it's awesome. But there's
really
the production is don't tell anybody. It's very small. Don't tell anybody.
Scott, let's talk a little bit about the book. How'd you choose? There's seven restaurants in the book.
You know, this project sprang from helping the Culinary Institute of America on a documentary they filmed last summer. I had met the media director of the CIA, the Culinary Institute, not the spy shop, John Barclay, in 2014 at a food event in Puebla. And at the time, they were doing these series of kind of short 5-minute vignettes on different chefs and street food all over the world called Savoring World Flavors. And I said to him, you know, that was the first time I met him, and then I met him at a couple of other food events, you know, in subsequent years. And I said to him, I said, John, you got to get your film crew to Baja California because throughout Mexico, he'd filmed in Mexico City. He'd filmed in Puebla. I think they were down in the Yucatan. I said, right now, it's happening in Baja California. You know, you've got a whole spate of chefs in that region that are just doing make-em-ups. They're creating new types of dishes based on the fresh ingredients there. They're fusing Mexican and European and Asian techniques and ingredients and recipes.
But which reflected the what was already happening on the ground and had been forever.
Hundreds of years.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But suddenly it's getting this recognition. So I said, you've got to get there. So finally, in 2017, John reached out to me and said, okay, we're finally going to do it. Can you help introduce us to the chefs and kind of help fix the show? And I was more than happy to. So they came on a little touring, you know, location scout. Drew was one of the chefs, of course, that we had to involve if you're going to talk about food in Baja California and Baja California cuisine. So we spent this past summer, I think it was in July, 7 days filming throughout Baja.
Mm-hmm.
Now, really only about 4 of those days were in the Valle, but 4 days in the Valle doesn't sound as good as 7 days. In the Valle, so I kind of
so you lied.
I stretched the truth a little bit.
He stayed on for a couple.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
it was actually 4 days of American time is 7 days of Mexican time, right?
Sure. Yeah, exactly. Okay. Yeah, that's it. Okay. Thanks, Michael, for doing the new math, for me. So we were, all over the place. Obviously spent a lot of time in the Valle. The seven, I figured, we did go to seven different restaurants and interviewed seven different chefs for this documentary, which is actually coming out next month. It's going to be a 90-minute documentary. From what I can tell, it's probably going to be the most comprehensive document on Baja California cuisine that's been made to date, at least English language.
I think I was actually at Deckman's when
we were there.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was a fun night, actually.
So is it fair to say that these restaurants, these chefs are what you would consider the most representative of the Valle? In other words, if somebody from San Diego or any place is going to the Valle, say, use this as your primary list?
I would say so. And then, you can branch out from there. But really, I mean, you've got the pioneers who I consider Drew as a pioneer, Javier Plasencia a pioneer, Diego Hernandez, and Roberto Alcacer from Malva are pioneers.
And Miguel Angel
Guerrero. And, of course, Miguel Angel Guerrero, who coined
Molina,
the term Baja.
Who started the whole campestre.
And we wouldn't have Diego without Benito.
Right.
Always
got to give kudos to Benito.
Yep.
He was on the forefront.
He was unfortunately out of town or otherwise busy. He might have been filming MasterChef down in Mexico. We couldn't get Benito, though. We would have loved to have had him appear. So you've got kind of these vanguard chefs, but then we also went to Doña Estela. And Doña Estela doesn't even know what Baja California cuisine is. From what I understand, she hasn't eaten at any of the restaurants in the Valle, but she's got her little farmhouse there where she's been cooking some of the best, rustic country Sinaloan recipes for breakfast. And somehow it just works in the Valle.
Well, let's hold that thought for a moment. We'll pick up right there with the second segment. We're going to conclude the first segment here, but at the end of each segment, we do a specially produce vegetable of the week, and the specially produce vegetable of the week this week is
fava beans.
Hey, fava beans.
So the question on the table is, what are you going to do with those?
Well, for me, when the favas start showing up, spring is officially here.
Yes.
It's one of my favorite vegetables. We have a big garden where we have the restaurant, and one of the things that does really, really well are the favas. And they're really versatile. When they're younger, you can actually eat all of this, which when they're older, that's not.
It's not advisable. In fact, it's downright poisonous if you do it too late.
we use the leaves from the fava beans as well in our salads,
which are fantastic.
Which are really, really nice. The way we do it when we use them, we blanch this first and then we peel these.
Yep.
So we get down to the little guys. Some people just don't take that time.
That's really not a good idea either.
Culinarily. It's a long – and then we split them, take the nose off is what I call it. And then with this, we can sauté them. We sometimes, if they're bigger, we'll slice them into like bâtonnets for salads, marinate them. We do purees. We do foams. We do raw. So
yeah, the young ones raw are absolutely the taste of spring.
Yeah, favas are awesome.
I like to have my fava beans with a little bit of sesos clarís. No,
the sesos are brains.
Yes, for
it's a reference to a.
It was a Silence of the Lambs reference. Sorry, I couldn't help.
And I'm going
to
cook it with lamb.
Oh, are you really? Yeah. Well, there you go. You can still hear him screaming for those fava beans, can't you, Michael?
I can, and with a nice Chianti.
Yes, of course.
A while back, we were eating at Kai. It was a tribal restaurant in Arizona, and the guy at the next table ordered his tribal buffalo medium well. So I would have liked to have had this to beat him over the head with.
this one would have done the trick.
That's not a bad idea.
You're gonna need a bigger. We're gonna need a bigger fava.
Yeah. Wait, that's what she said.
And I wasn't the first one to tell a sex joke on this show. Well, with that note, we will see you back. If you're on Facebook Live, we'll see you back in about 5 minutes. And if not, we'll see you back in about 2 weeks.
Don't go away. We're going to still have the feed going, but we're going to take a little break.
The Specialty Produce app is the world's number one handheld resource on produce. The app features photographs, recipes, geography and history, taste and culinary applications on over 1,900 produce items. From apples to zapote, we've got your produce questions answered. Our app is available for both iPhone and Android. Download our app for free today.